Hello and welcome to the Non-Breaking Space Show. Our guest for this episode is Sean Michael O'Keefe. He's the producer for the annual South by Southwest Interactive Festival in Austin, Texas. Jonathan can be found on Twitter at Sean O'Keefe and blogs at seanokeefe.com. Your heroic hosts for this episode are Christopher Schmidt and Sam Kapp, and together they talk with Sean about being in bands, rocking some fonts, and how South by Southwest is put together and put on each year. We went a little longer in this discussion with Sean, so we'll skip all the formalities and jump right into the interview. Enjoy.
Hi, Sean.
Hello.
Hey, Sean, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Just want to introduce you to Sam Capilla.
Hi.
Hi, Sam.
And thanks for being on the show. We're really honored that you could take some time out of your...
How are y'all doing today?
Ah, man, doing great. It's I think we have a cold front of 100 degree weather today, so that's pretty nice. It's not 106, so that's pretty nice. Very good. How are you doing?
I'm great. You know, I just got back from Las Vegas and our inaugural South by Southwest V event there, and I'm happy to report that it was actually cooler in Las Vegas than it was in Austin this week.
So. Wow.
You know something's gone horribly wrong when that's the case. So.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
We're just really happy to have you on the show. But one of the questions we always ask is how you got into the web. And so I just want to just because our industry, our generation is like, we didn't really just, go to school directly to get on the web or something like that. So we actually kind of like backed into it. So I was wondering, what was your story of how you got into the web?
Oh, goodness. I have to talk about these details, huh? I'm of a demographic that sometimes referred to as Gen X, I guess. I actually came to the world of computers, fairly young. My dad was involved in moving data out of mainframes for insurance companies in the late 70s and early 80s. So my first computer was an Apple II.
Nice.
And I would dork out writing basic programs and playing Choplifter a lot.
Nice.
I took somewhat of an absence, I guess, from it for a while once I started playing music. And actually, rock and roll kind of stole my soul for a while. And I did a bunch of stuff with bands throughout the 90s. And then really kind of, started using technology to record music and do a lot of different things that way, and really kind of got sucked back in that way. And I guess when I was at the University of Texas, started using this thing called email. It just kind of fell into place from there. I've been through all the crazy stages of, trying to hoard as many America Online CD codes or whatever. I'm doing all kinds of crazy things with computers, but I guess it wasn't really until some point in the late 90s I started, building websites and, being like, wow, this, mysterious thing called the internet is actually, fairly easy to build content on, because the old code from my youth of, 10 print, quote, whatever, was remarkably similar to this stuff called HTML.
Cool. So what bands were you in?
Oh, dear. You're going to make me neither confirm nor deny the various bands. I think the only one that people would have heard of was American Analog Set. Ken and those guys were gracious enough to have me join the band and tour with them throughout the late 90s for a while. And it was a great experience. And I think that, more than anything, it just kind of confirmed that, kind of what I was talking about before, this kind of convergence of what was happening at that time with the music industry and technology. It was a great, great experience. I got to tour around the country various times and play in a lot of clubs and sleep on hardwood floors, and decided that spending my time in front of a computer was more comfortable than spending my time on a hardwood floor. So
what was your instrument, or your instruments?
I'm sorry.
Oh, what instrument did you play?
I guess I'm more of that singer, guitarist, frontman dude, obviously enough. But I, in American Analog set, I ran sound on a lot of the tours, and I also played guitar and percussion.
Nice. Cool.
Was there a lot of MySpace involved at the time?
You know, it's funny. That was the era. It's a little later. A little later on, there was the era of MySpace. I think we're still at that time stuck in mostly just like sending email around to people. But the MySpace wave, I think, hit shortly after I was in the band. And oddly enough, I guess I had various projects that were on MySpace for music, but I'd always avoided having a personal MySpace account. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up one day, this was kind of the first lesson I learned, that if you don't control your online identity, somebody else will, which is an important lesson to learn. And I learned it the hard way because one of my friends created a MySpace page for me that had a lovely mixture of details of half true and obviously some rather colorful things that were not true. But it was enough to where most of my friends and family recognized it as potentially being me. And then I found out because somebody had gotten really upset because I had not asked them to be their friend on MySpace. Mm-hmm. I was like, what are you talking about? I don't have a MySpace page. And the rest is history after that. So at that point, I really had, grabbed the domain in my own name and really started, doing that on a lot of different platforms to appropriately represent myself so that people wouldn't pull pranks on me and others. So.
Wow.
Cool. Yeah, that's kind of crazy. Yeah, you always hear about people stealing identities, but yeah, just like, I guess that is stealing identity to some extent, right? So.
Yeah, it's like, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's somebody you know. So it's like all crime. It's you know, people close to you.
So in the late 90s, you started building websites. What was your first website that you built?
Wow. I had a couple. I think my first website that I actually built, that I don't even know if I had kept it up that long, was for a production company that a buddy of mine and I had. We would do, you know, music and some kind of film production, but mostly audio and engineering. And so that was called Invid Productions, I think. Yeah. But the first real one that I think I did was a personal blog called SoLab. And then that kind of mutated into Design Ops. So, you know, right, I guess, the turn of the century, it was really a pretty amazing time for the web. And I think, you know, I kind of look back and really kind of echo a lot of the sentiments that, you know, Anil Dash referred to recently in his, you know, The Web We Lost post that, you know, had a lot of traction. And, you know, back in, I don't know, 2000, 2001, 2 and 3, you know, everybody was just experimenting, doing all these crazy things. You know, obviously blogging was, you know, blowing up. And, you know, but even from just our perspective, you know, people were doing these experimental portfolios and all kinds of cool stuff. And at the time, I was really just loving design on the web and all the amazing things you could find. And so I started archiving a lot of what I was finding, essentially just aggregating content in a site called Design Ops. And I did that for a couple years. You know, there was no advertising. It was just this labor of love. And, you know, I knew that it was kind of semi-successful when people started contacting me to, like, design things for them, and that I was like, wait a minute, like, maybe I should consider doing a lot of this, you know, for other people on a more formal basis. And so at that time is really when I kind of on the side just kind of launched a freelance design business. And ironically, that was about the time that I started taking on more responsibilities at South by Southwest for their web front end. Mm-hmm. Largely because I started bitching about how bad our website was, and internally, and you know, because Hugh and I were really struggling at that time to convince folks of the value of Southwest Interactive. And it was right after the .com bubble had burst, and everybody was interested in going to very niche conferences about you know, whether mostly like, you know, wireless telecom conferences or things like that. And, you know, we really saw the value of an event that showcased the intersection between all these different sectors in the industry and emerging technology. And it took a while for people to really recognize that outside of a core group of people that had been building that event for a long time since the late 90s. So yeah, it was around that time that I really started getting my hands dirty in a lot of CSS technologies that were emerging at the time, and really kind of looking at web standards and how that was such an important part to how the web functioned.
Yeah, and it's how it functions. And so design ops, is that still around, or is it still up, or is it this?
Oh, you know, I redirected it at one point to my personal site. I don't know when that happened. That was a long time ago. But oddly enough, I was recently I was looking at the Wayback Machine, trying to grab screenshots for all of these things, just kind of like, you know, realizing that at the time I had built all those blogs, both SoLab, which stood for Sean O'Keefe Laboratories. So SoLab and DesignOps were built on Pivot, which at the time was a database-free blogging software that just used permissions to, you know, overwrite and create different files. And that was attractive to me at the time because I didn't know anything about databases. And I was like, oh, do I want to learn, like, you know, SQL and mess with all that? I don't know. And ended up using Pivot for a while until, I guess, what did I use after that? I think I played with Movable Type for a while after that, and ultimately ended up getting into bed with WordPress and using that kind of exclusively for a lot of those side projects and passion projects. So now, like, all of my personal sites, like SeanO'Keefe.com and Rock That Font, and then Yuptastic, which is kind of an umbrella company that my wife and I have for various creative endeavors, they're all run on WordPress. And as, you know, Chris, you may have known just from seeing Drupal, you know, Southwest is on Drupal, and I've done a lot of projects in that environment. So yeah, it was kind of a crazy time, but I do need to kind of go back up and fire up Pivot again and see if I can get those old sites up and running. It'd be fun to play with.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that we saw each other at the Drupal Camp, Austin, was it? And I just loved your presentation. That was really, really awesome. And there's like, I tweeted the heck out of that thing.
Thank you.
So, and one of the points you made, like, to think about, like, talking about, like, online identity and making sure you own it, is, like, you mentioned, it's like, have a personal site, you know, and not make it your, it doesn't have to be, and the reason why you said, like, it was, like, it doesn't have to be about your personal brand, but that you own your own data, and that you said, like, what was it, that you, pictures of your family don't have to be on Facebook. Right, and that it goes back to, like, you know, trying to go back and find all this data, like, you know, on the Wayback Machine and stuff like that. So, and I found that this is really awesome that that they have that. But again, it kind of, like, my question about that was, one, I think it's totally, totally awesome just to have your own website, just, you know, for branding purposes and for posting stuff like that, and, you know, for all that data. But one question I have is, there are services like Wayback Machine, and do you post it on the internet, you know? Do you really need to have it backed up, or do you just want to rely on third party services?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I certainly recognize that, you know, folks get a lot of value out of using these other platforms, and that's great. I mean, I certainly have used them on and off for a long time, and I think I mentioned to you that I actually left Facebook at some point early last year because I didn't really like the way that they were running a company, and I wasn't, you know, personally getting the value out of it. And yeah, it's easy for me to say because I know how to fire up, you know, other streams of content and other channels. But, you know, so yeah, I think obviously we all kind of slice and dice kind of what we do online in various ways. you know, one of the interesting things is when I talk with people about, you know, when they're surprised, like, oh, you're not on Facebook or whatever, and everybody I talk to is like, oh, yeah, I get it. You know, I'm only on there now because of my family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of where that came from is like, you know, yeah, I get it that, like, your mom and, you know, all of our grandparents or whatever are on Facebook now, and that's super cool in so many different ways. But, you know, to me it was just like, in that talk, you know, an important thing to realize that, you know, there are other options out there and there are a lot of other great options and different things that you can do to have your family involved and share your life with them and connect online. And, you know, I just think that it's important to kind of really help shape where the web is going by, you know, how we use the technology that we use. You know, I do have a lot of, it kind of comes from my really rock and roll upbringing, playing in bands, right? I mean, there's an analogy there to, like, you know, we're going to put out our own records. You know, we're in this kind of for the right reasons. It's the process of making the records themselves, which is part of the art form, and having that control and having that ownership. And I think that, you know, my projects on the web should be no different. And yeah, as a result, you know, I don't want other people using pictures of my kids in ways that I haven't authorized and change the terms of service and, you know, just things like that. You know, I want to maintain control over my content, over my data. And you know, I mean, I this is with a full understanding of why companies, not just Facebook, but various other companies have the terms of service and policies they do. I get it. You know, we have the same challenges at South Pacific West. But yeah, I think it's a choice that I've made, you know, to really support the indie web, and I think that other people should do the same and really work towards, you know, getting control of what they do online, whether it be through, you know, whether you're just talking about content or your own voice or, you know, just platforms you use or the how private your information is online. Obviously, we've had all this crazy NSA stuff going on recently. And the kind of national discussions. And so, yeah, that's just kind of my take on it. And again, it's really just kind of comes out of my growing up at a time, kind of the new wave and post-new wave punk rock era playing music. And I kind of, that's all I know what to do when it comes to the web. So
yeah, it seems, and I don't know, this is kind of like a overwrought thing about it, but it was just, you know, we went from AOL dominating, you know, everywhere, like you have CD-ROMs everywhere, like AOL is the internet, to people building their blogs and systems like that, and the era of movable type where you had to install, you know, movable type on your server or your web host, and now we have services like Facebook coming up where it's all web-based, you don't need an operating system, and then it's almost kind of like, you know, Facebook is the internet, right? So it's for a lot of people, so it's...
Yeah.
So it's... But yeah, so and not realizing like how much potential it is just to build your own, you know, publishing empire, if you will.
And, yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't think, you know, I mean, I think you brought up a really interesting point. It's about the balance, right? Mm-hmm. If Facebook is serving, you know, most everyone's needs and essentially acting as the internet for the majority of people on the planet, you know, where's the kind of where are the controls and kind of balance of power in that, you know? And I just think that there really needs to be a lot more diversity in people's online experiences, you know, so that they're open to having conversations outside of Facebook, whether it be on Twitter, you know, via their own site, other forums like, you know, Reddit or Metafilter or wherever. I just think that, you know, that dialogue needs to happen everywhere because I think, you know, as we know, you know, with the filter bubble, we tend to kind of only reinforce what we want to hear and people who agree with us. And I think that's mm-hmm. a little too easy to do on Facebook, particularly when Facebook is also doing the same thing, kind of serving you ads of things that you're interested in. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff they've done with the social graph is fascinating. You know,
right.
You know, somebody who does a lot of marketing is responsible for a lot of that. It's South by Southwest. I mean, it's a marketer's dream, and I get it, but I think at the same time, you have to be really cognizant of, you know, what your experience in Facebook is like when you're reinforcing who your friends are. Facebook is reinforcing what content and ads are served to you, and they're helping control that and shape that. You know, it's not, I guess, as diverse and open as it should be in a lot of different ways. And so, and yeah, it's hard. It's hard. You know, I mean, I think the trend is more and more is that, you know, I mean, you remember when we used to have various, there's still some services around bookmarking services, you know, but like having a collection of all your bookmarks and, you know, waking up in the morning and reading like 10 to 20 websites, you know, it's like harder and harder to do that over time.
Right.
Because you're just like, oh, well, I'm just looking at Twitter.
Right.
Or just looking at this, you know, big fire hose of information pouring out, and you find things in different ways. And that's certainly amazingly valuable. But I think, you know, there's a lot of interesting consequences. You know, I mean, people have talked a lot about long form content on the web and, you know, just again, that push for us only digesting culture in 140 characters at a time or just a couple of Facebook posts at a time.
You were talking about bookmarking services before. I think we got cut off about how, like, and long form content and so on, too. So,
yeah, I probably rambled on for another minute or two.
But no, yeah.
I think talking about how, you know, you used to, your experience on the web was much more diverse because you, you know, have all these bookmarks of all these different sites and be able to see a lot of long form content and not just digest the web, you know, in 140 characters at a time or in Facebook posts, you know, from various friends, you know, that it was more about just the diversity of experience online. And yeah, and I miss those days. And there's nothing from stopping people from doing that today. It's just, you know, obviously these, you know, other streams, you know, are giving a lot of value. But it's just, you know, important to realize that it's a very different experience. And, you know, I guess on one level it could be analogous on some way to, like, you know, the active listening of a vinyl record, for example, versus kind of more passive of just like having a web streaming service online in the background while you do other work. They're kind of very different experiences. And I think that, you know, they both have value. But, you know, on the web, when, you know, when you're talking about how you get, you know, your information and make decisions in the world around you based on that, you know, it's important to have that diversity and get outside your filter bubble.
Right. Well, it's also an issue of like long form versus short form versus the quality of the content.
Yeah.
And also like the repetition, because I feel like a lot of people do short and quasi decent quality, but at rapid succession. And that kind of replaces the need to actually, not replaces the need, but it feels like it like they try to fill that hole of long form, but like on a monthly calendar schedule or something like that. And so I feel like that's kind of lost. And I find this very with like the TV shows that are coming out now where there's so much padding into the TV shows where, like, in case you missed it, here, we'll take a minute to miss what you missed if you haven't joined us in the last 15 minutes. I'm like, well, like, so it totally hoses the people who invested the last 15 minutes of their lives in the TV show. And there's, you know, the kind of thing. Yeah,
I see that. I mean, you know, like The Daily Show is a great example of that where they'll bring on some awesome guest and right when they start getting into the meat of it, they're like, okay, you can see the rest of the interview on the web. And
right.
I think that's probably a good solution for them, but yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, I think it's, you know, long form content is really valuable. And I think, you know, there's a lot of different issues. There's the kind of production issue of it's really difficult to, you know, spend time and make that kind of content. I mean, I certainly am the first to have kind of suffered the consequences of, you know, using Twitter most of the time and, I love doing that, you know, but I have to consciously kind of always, oh, you know, like one of the things that, you know, I think a number of months ago, one of my personal mantras or things I was trying to do is, you know, blog more and retweet less. And that was kind of, and it was funny watching the retweets on that one. But I think, you know, it's just an important, just, you know, from the production and kind of personal experience of sharing thoughts, but, you know, also at the same time, you know, it's important to make time to read, you know, on the web and read, you know, these long articles about important subjects, whether it be, you know, coding or something of more of a political nature. So it's kind of, there's the consumption end of it as well.
And it fascinates me that there's a lot of these read it later sort of services because we have to do that.
Exactly.
We've gotten to that point.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's also read it later. Like, do people actually go back and read it later, or is that just? Or just as me, because I said to read it later. I'm like, I never go back to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I think like a lot of times once you kind of, you know, press those buttons and kind of archive that away, it becomes kind of like a reference material, you know, that you may not go back to. So
right.
I don't enough. I don't, you know, do it often enough. So.
Well, like also like it kind of it gets that whole thing of, I'm not sure this, how relevant it is, but like you know, I write books and for the web industry and stuff like that, and the most depressing point in time is like after you spend 3, 6, 8 a year writing a book, is that one edition of my books, I was, you know, I put a Google alert for it, I was able to get the pirated copy PDF of it faster than the actual like book arrived from the publisher at my doorstep. and I was just like, and I talked to my publisher like, oh my gosh, this is so depressing that people can actually get this new material for, you know, just pirated for it for free. And they said like, well, yeah, that stinks. However, just realize people are going to do that, but they're not going to read it. I'm like, that's even worse. They just like collect it. They don't want to like actually go through it and just say that they have it and not say they actually need it or something like that. So
that's interesting.
Yeah. So that's why I think about it. Every time I hit read it later, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to bother. Okay. So, and I do want to talk about the Rock That Font project and let people know about it more, but if you want to talk about some more, but it's, and you can tell me, let me just paraphrase what I think it is, and then you can like expound on it, but you know,
sure.
I like it. It's about the topography and the you know, rock albums. It doesn't obviously doesn't have to be rock albums, but music albums and what type of typefaces they use and stuff like that. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean that's the short of it. I think what's our tagline? The semi-verified, you know, like intersection of rock and roll and typography and all its glory or something like that. But yeah, I had the opportunity back in 2007-ish, 8-ish to introduce Gary Helvetica at South by Southwest for one of his screenings on, Gary Hustwit.
I was like, is that a rock band? Because that sounds awesome.
Yeah, he'd probably kill me for saying that. But yeah, Gary Hustwit's Helvetica, which, you know, I don't know if you guys have seen, but if you haven't, it's an amazing film about, you know, the story of Helvetica and how it became so ubiquitous.
Dude, I was in the audience when it happened.
Okay, well, there you go. Yeah. So, and that, you know, that film just really, you know, impacted me in terms of just thinking a lot more about how information was transferred to me in the world around me and particularly through typography and the, you know, the clothes that words wear. And, you know, for me, a lot of that was going back to my rock and roll roots and, you know, looking at album covers. And I'd always loved doing those kind of projects personally. And I kicked around this idea for a long time and then finally launched it, I guess about 2 or 3 years ago now, with some friends, Eric Hurtgen, who's a designer, an artist, and Charlotte, and then a DJ out of New York, actually Queens. Not allowed to say he's from New York anymore, but Les Jacobs. And so the three of us kind of just started writing about the intersection of typography and rock and roll and really talking about the art direction of a lot of the records that we loved growing up with. And it was a lot of fun, and we had a lot of fun with it. And I knew that... it had kind of tapped into this vein in the community when we started getting approached by different artists who had done a lot of these record covers, like Howard Wakefield, who worked a lot with Peter Saville on a lot of the New Order and Joy Division stuff. Like, we did an interview with him, which was great. And then we've got some other stuff coming up that I can't quite talk about that's pretty cool. I mean, you know, some guys done amazing things and some of these great typefaces. And so, you know, it really started out as me just kind of sharing my own educational journey into typography. which is kind of an infinite journey, So, but yeah, we have a lot of fun with it, and I think, you know, I guess I can tell you guys this first to kind of know we're about to kind of give the site away to the community, so to speak, and basically make it a lot easier for folks to just get involved and become guest contributors on their own. And I think it'll be fun to see, you know, how that evolves as a result of that. Taking much more of an open platform approach to it. And, you know, right now we definitely invite anybody to participate and, you know, post articles about their favorite records and, you know, the fonts used on those records and artists. But, you know, I want to make it a lot easier to do for people to send in stuff and really be much more collaborative. And I think long term, you know, I'd love to see kind of essentially a database or archive of all these amazing records and the different, you know, typefaces that were used on them and, you know, the different artists without, you know, because right now, you know, most of the, I mean, first of all, as I've found, like most of the artists, you know, who may have developed these, you know, album covers, you know, they weren't always documented very well. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, perhaps the person that did most of the heavy lifting, you know, didn't really get credit on the final record. And yeah, and this was, if you go back, especially to like, you know, 70s and 80s where, you know, these like awesome gatefolds and you had so much more real estate to work within. And now, you know, most designers, when, you know, they're approaching kind of the parameters and constraints for what something needs to look like, they're like, all right, what's this going to look like on an iPod or just, you know, in a browser at the, you know, at this small, you know, pixel ratio or whatever. So, so yeah, I think, you know, it's nice because it kind of celebrates, you know, both old and new, and it's just fun to share that educational journey with everybody. And, you know, I wish, you know, my only regret is not having more time to develop content for the site. We're kind of definitely more of the long form, you know, kind of a level of detail that it takes a long time to kind of do historical research and then contact the folks involved and see if they want to participate. And then it's just, yeah, it's tough to kind of carve out enough time to do that. And it's, you know, again, it's a labor of love. The site's been ad-free for, like I said, 2 or 3 years. And we just do it just because we love it. And but yeah, I'd love to see it become more of a community platform and kind of build in some features and tools to kind of facilitate that. And I think that that'll be Rock That Font 3.0, I guess. So,
cool. So, how, do you mind if I ask about the technology to make it more open submission platform? Is it just?
Yeah, I mean, like as far as like what we use to build it, or
yeah, like yeah.
Yeah,
I'm,
I mean,
I'm a nerd, by the way. I don't want to let you know that.
Yeah, me too. I mean, we use WordPress for it.
Mm-hmm.
I started the first Rock That Font version was just kind of a theme that I had kind of cooked up and modified from a few others. And, you know, it worked well for a while. And then we realized that because we weren't producing a lot of content,
mm-hmm.
we wanted to kind of build an interface that would let people kind of see the whole catalog and kind of deep dive into content, you know, that may be a year or two old, a little bit easier. And I ended up kind of stumbling across this guy that, I guess he's pretty popular now. He's under the name Shaken and Stirred. He does a lot of WordPress themes. And there was one of his themes that at the time was really new and you know, didn't have a lot of traction, that basically I could present all the record covers, you know, essentially, or as many as I wanted to on the front page, on the home destination. Had all the right kind of bells and whistles of being responsive and, you know, basically mobile version, all kinds of stuff. You know, it's very friendly in all the right ways. And I like that about it. And so I think that was maybe a year and a half ago,
mm-hmm.
we launched that new version of the site, just using mostly Shaken and Stirred code and modified a few things to suit our needs. And kind of went from there, you know, as far as the process of, you know, writing posts, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's us kind of going out and finding a record that we love.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, trying to do the research on who the artist is and see, you know, where they are, and sometimes we'll reach out to them, and other times we'll just write more from the music side of it about, you know, what we loved, and you know, when the, for example, the typeface might be kind of obvious or developed by somebody who's no longer around. Yeah, so that's kind of the basic part of that process, and I think it's different for all of us. You know, Eric Hurtgen is really good at, just because he's much more of a hipster than I am these days, he usually knows a lot of the folks involved in a lot of newer release records, mm-hmm. And so he's able to, you know, get feedback from, you know, records that have been released rather recently. Like, he's done, you know, some really cool stuff with, like, one of the latest Arcade Fire records, and gosh, a lot of different bands. And then, you know, whereas I'm more into like the deep dive into the past and finding, you know, a record that, you know, I grew up with, that, you know, whether it was, you know, Von Oliver or somebody else, and kind of looking back at, kind of at that particular time, what the challenges were in typography and things like that. So one of my favorite ones was recently we did like Unrest, that band Unrest, so back in like the early 90s. That was like a band that I listened to, and kind of taking a deep dive into that, back to, you know, who developed that typeface. You know, somebody that had worked in the UK forever doing, you know, cutting Ruby with, and like, you had basically seen 50 or 60 year old span of how typography changed from the analog world to the digital world. And so it's just been amazing to kind of talk with folks like that.
Cool. So are you going to be sticking with WordPress for the next version, for the open collaboration, or?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I think for our purposes, we're, you know, I know the ins and outs of WordPress really well, and I think for the purposes of the site, it, you know, it's hard to find kind of a better platform out there that suits my needs. I think what I'll probably have to do is probably develop a custom theme, kind of go full custom for us again, just depending on how we decide to, you know, integrate some of the community features that we'd like to do. I still kind of haven't really mapped that out. It's just been something that we know we want to do. We just haven't kind of connected the dots on exactly how we're going to do it. And hopefully kicking around some innovative ways to make it really easy for folks to participate and not, you know, have, feel like they have to do the same kind of long form thing. So we're probably going to create another layer, you know, probably tied to some social channels where if people just want to archive particular font on one of their favorite records, they can do that, but we'll also kind of have this long form channel. It's kind of more the deep dive into history, and then the designer interviews and things like that.
Typeio, I don't know if you've heard of it, typ.io is a catalog for web type, and it's basically anybody can upload a screenshot of any website, and then they list, you know, did they use Typekit, what typefaces did they use, there's a couple of tags. Based off of it, you can like things or share things, and it's an interesting, I mean, there's no other content other than posting the link, posting the service that hosts the typeface, and then listing the typefaces itself in a screenshot, but it's interesting.
Yeah, when Typeio came out, I was like totally like, oh man, of course, like that's exactly what we're doing with Rock That Font, but like they're doing it on the web, and I love it, it's great, and it's cool how they've integrated everything. I love seeing, like, there's a couple of people I follow on Twitter who are always you know, grabbing different typefaces and using their social features. So it's definitely cool to have that archived. Particularly on the web. I mean, one of the interesting things about, you know, Rock That Font is you really, like, you can, a lot of the records that, you know, I grew up listening to were in the pre-digital era. Sorry. And so, you know, learning a lot about how typography worked back then, either before the computer or just when you know, desktop publishing was really coming on board. And it's interesting to see how the actual, you know, production processes impacted how the records ended up looking, how that creative process worked. I think like 4AD is a great label to look at, whether it's Von Oliver or some of their other artists that really were, you know, using, you know, Photoshop and some, you know, in really unique ways at the time, doing a lot of layering and transparency and to really, you know, brand 4AD and all the artists at the time. And so, yeah, you get to see that like really clearly. It's really cool. But yeah, again, I think it's like what I love about it too is, and this is something that Christopher, you're mentioning earlier, like that I brought up in my Drupal Camp talk was this idea of like, you know, knowledge having a shelf life, and you know how it's part of our job to, you know, build these archives of things in the digital world, you know, because I think that, you know, and because I did have some experience in my young life before the internet, you know, recognizing how quickly all the formats change, all the platforms change, all the hardware changes, and making sure that you always have access to your information, with content that you've produced as well as content just out there. I think that you know, idea that we're all librarians and we all have a responsibility to kind of preserve knowledge. I think it is, and maybe it's because I hang out with too many archaeologists, but like that's I think something that is important for everybody to think about.
Right. I think, yeah, definitely it's important to just, you know, I like the idea of having your own brand just so that you, you know, like you said, like, you know, control your online identity so no one else does, but make sure you, it's not like in case anyone's interested, you know, it's pretty, the best part is like if they come across your website or Twitter, like you're ready to present, whether it's like the middle of the night for them and they're just checking something out or you're talking to a potential client or something like that. So it's always,
you know, exactly. I think, you know, along that kind of concept of like, we're all librarians and, you know, the keepers of knowledge in this world now that, you know, knowledge is accessible, via the internet in such an amazing way. But you're right. I mean, like your personal life, that's your journey. And I think so many people document, you know, their journey, whether it's photos of their family or just their thoughts about the industry, you know, documenting that online, you know, not just for others, but for yourself, I think is important to have the kind of appropriate perspective about the industry. And I think too, it's like, it's part of a psychological process, right? Like, you know, reading kind of your own thoughts online kind of helps, you know, you learn about how you know, project your voice out into the world and how ridiculous you may sound and how, you know, it helps you really better communicate your ideas to others, which is, I think, a big part of it too. I mean, I certainly, you know, I think I mentioned that talk, I've learned more, you know, getting Rock That Font off the ground, than anything else I've worked on. And I think it's because of how engaged I was in that project, that it was something that was driven by passion. And, you know, whether that's me becoming a better writer, or, you know, me becoming a better coder, I mean, it's across the board. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, that's, people ask me, like, I used to teach web design development. And so one of the things I always do is I ask students to pick their own personal project to build a website around. Because other than that, you know, if I tell them to build a website about XYZ, they're not going to be interested in building it. But if there's a passion they bring to it, like, you know, typography on record albums, they know the content, they love the content, they love being around that content, and that'll help them get over hurdles to learn that stuff. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you're engaged, you're passionate about something, you're going to learn it so much better. You're going to learn it faster. It's going to be a joy. And instead of just, you know, a lot of us, you know, you'll be in a job and you're like, oh, okay, I've got to learn this stuff to do this and execute on this. And it's just different. It's just different.
Yeah. So I do like to probably transition a little bit of gears, but hopefully not too many. But so in the late 90s, we're building websites, and then how did you get to work at South by Southwest?
Okay. Yeah. I've been at Southwest 13 years now, almost 14. I don't know. I'm losing count. But I oddly enough, I had, you know, I took a long time to go through the University of Texas because I was dropping out to go tour with American Analog Set. And this reminds me of this quote in the movie Better Off Dead, I don't know, with John Cusack that I love, but the character who most people know is, I guess, Booger from Revenge of the Nerds. Or anyways, he talks about, he's like, you know, Lane, I've been going to the school for 7.5 years. I'm no dummy, you know, whatever. So it's kind of like, reminds me of that. That was my college experience at UT. But I ended up, I studied a lot of different things, like everything from aerospace engineering to astronomy and physics to ended up finally finding where my heart really was in the communication school and the RTF program, because they had a program at the time called New Media, which is basically the department trying to catch up with what was happening in the digital world. And so I ended up finally finding what I was passionate about, and ended up meeting Wei, who was a TA of mine at the time. He's like, hey, you're in all this music stuff, and you're a geek, you know, why don't you come volunteer for South by Southwest? And I really wasn't that familiar with what South by Southwest was. I mean, I knew the music side of it, you know, had vaguely heard of the interactive side of it. And then I volunteered back in March of 2000, met Hugh for the first time. And that was really a big part of cementing my transition that was already kind of happening into like the digital world and into the web, because I saw everything around me. And I don't remember, who was it? What was her name? That she was one of the first people to do like, you know, 24/7 webcam of her life. I'll remember her name in a minute. But, you know, being exposed to all these amazing experiments of what was happening and with the digital and the physical world. I was just at that point, you know, really inspired. And then an opening came up for somebody to produce the, at the time, what was called the Web Awards. And so in November of 2000, I came on board to help produce that. And so at that point in time, you know, realized that Interactive was, you know, Hugh Forrest, our director, and me, and a salesperson. And it was like that for a long time. And now, you know, we have a team, depending on what time of year it is, of 20 to 30 people just for Interactive. And so that first full Subsist event and as a staffer in 2001, I think it was like the peak of the Dow Jones, you know, it was like the dot-com bubble was big. And then the following March, I think it was at the lowest point that at least the NASDAQ had ever been. And so it was a really interesting time to kind of come into South by Southwest and start working with Hugh and start working on the Web Awards. And as a result, you know, I kind of got to see a lot of amazing work. You know, people would submit their creative projects, you know, from all over the globe. And, you know, this was back when you had all these large online design portals like Design is Kinky and 10K and all these, you know, the importance of like the online portal and these content aggregators. That's what everybody would go check out every day, you know, whether they would go to that website and, you know, kind of look at all the cool work that had been posted. And so, but yeah, I guess the rest is kind of history, as they say. We kind of went through a number of years, you know, really just, as I mentioned before, trying to, you know, tell the story of why South by Southwest was a really valuable place to be in March. And I think in, yeah, later on, things started to kind of grow. And but yeah, that's I think pretty much how I got involved as a volunteer. And then, yeah.
Wei used to actually be my shift leader when I was volunteering.
I should add that, you know, Wei had recommended me for the job, and then when he finally finished his PhD after what I would call the Better Off Dead program at the university as well, we were able to hire him a few years ago to come on full-time. So it's kind of this neat full-circle thing that, you know, the man responsible for really getting me involved in the event. You know, now, you know, works on the team with me, and we all, you know, have a great time doing the event every March.
And so it's, you know, it's grown from, like, I guess you guys are trying to convince people why they should come to South by Southwest in March to, I don't know, do you still do that? I mean, it just seems like, is there still a need to do that? Because it's grown so,
yeah,
so
massively. Now we're like, don't come in March. No, yeah, I mean, it's obviously, I think, you know, a big tipping point, just for lack of a better word, as punny as that may be, it was in 2005, you know, we had Malcolm Gladwell speak at the event, mm-hmm. and we saw a lot of growth then, and obviously with Twitter hitting its tipping point in 2007, and then, you know, interactive, you know, very much being a kind of internet in real life, you know, followed the growth of a lot of these social channels like Twitter and Facebook, and yeah, so we, you know, a big part of my role and responsibilities here is in terms of marketing and strategy and trying to, you know, basically get the different departments, the music, film, and interactive, to kind of work together and present the best Southwest experience we can. So I head up a lot of our efforts with Convergence in that way. And yeah, so we... You know, I mentioned, I guess when we kicked off the interview, that I just got back from our first event in Vegas, which was a startup and entrepreneurial-focused event, but across all the creative industries. So we had a couple of nights of music showcases, a special film screening, and a kind of, you know, and from our perspective, a very kind of unusual diversity of presentations, you know, kind of with the really broad definition of what a startup is and what an entrepreneur is, and in a certain sense. You know, we all are entrepreneurs in our own ways, you know, whether it's our passion project or whether it's somebody playing in a band, which is pretty much almost anybody in Austin, or, you know, anything else. And, you know, so far, you know, we've got a lot of feedback to look through, but people were really excited about V2V because it was, you know, we kept hearing again, you know, like, oh, this is just like the way Southwest was back in, you know, 2004 and 2005 and 2006 and, you know, a much smaller, more boutique, mm-hmm. just a different kind of intimacy. I mean, obviously the signal to noise ratio at the March event is very different. You know, it takes much more energy to kind of find your friends and, you know, but it's interesting, you know, to that issue of growth, I mean, having been at South by Southwest so long, you know, we hear a lot of people that, you know, just like to complain, kind of this myth of the golden past, you know, like, oh, Southwest sucks now. It used to be so much better. And you know, and I'm like, wait a minute, you know, I was there and, you know, there's more cool shit at Southwest now than there ever was before. Granted, the challenge is finding it, you know, having the right filters and tools on being able to navigate the event now, you know, we understand is a very challenging thing. And, you know, we're always working to make that a better experience and kind of create these, you know, different micro events, you know, within South by Southwest and around these, you know, particular topics and subjects, so that you can find like-minded creatives. And I think, you know, what people loved about V2V is that, you know, again, it took any of the navigational challenges out of it. You know, we were at the Cosmopolitan, in Las Vegas, which is a great venue. And so, you know, you'd walk out of a room and run into the same people that you did before and be able to kind of pick up the conversation. And so there's real value in that. And I think really that's what we're trying to do with V2V is just create kind of another option that delivers, you know, a different value to the end user and to folks that are participating in that community. And that's really the way we look at it is like, here's another platform, you know, for folks that, you know, have been coming to the March event for a long time, or perhaps somebody that just wants to experience South by Southwest in a different way.
So why not cap South by Southwest Austin instead of reaching out?
Sure. I mean, it's a good question. And, you know, that was something that I fought for pretty hard back in the day, as well as a few others here. You know, and you know, I lost that battle, and in many ways, it was a good thing that I did. And here's why: we always wanted South by Southwest to be open and available to the independent developer. As we knew that if we capped the event at a lower number, like a lot of events do, that the nature of the community would change. in terms of, you know, prices would, you know, skyrocket in certain ways and just, you know, whatever laws of supply and demand would happen. But it would just no longer be accessible for those who we feel were really doing amazing things. And so that was something that, you know, we were conscious of. And that's why we always do different kinds of programs, you know, different kinds of ways to participate in the event that lets people that, you know, are doing innovative work, you know, who, you know, may not always have, you know, big budgets to come to the event to at least participate in some way
right.
and come to South Sweat. So that was a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the funny thing, like back when these discussions were going on, back in, 2009, 10, 11, whatever, we weren't too worried about it because we're like, well, there's only a certain number of hotels and there's only a certain number of flights in the city, so there'll be like a natural cap on the event. And what we didn't, you know, really calculate for is the whole HomeAway and Airbnb phenomenon and just the true, you know, drive and determination that so many in the community had to get to the event. And so it definitely has grown a lot. But and you know, yeah, I mean, honestly, you know, Hugh and I and the rest of the company and team, you know, really struggle with what's the right balance on this, what's working and what isn't working. And the nice thing about South by Southwest is that, you know, every year is different. We rebuild so much of the event from the ground up every year based on community feedback that it's a different experience every time. And so things that were problematic the year before likely won't be the next year. And so it's kind of cool in that way. I was meeting with a group of MBA students from the McCombs Business School here in Austin. And we've done some various kind of programs with them where they kind of help us solve problems. And in this recent meeting, you know, they were talking all about, you know, sharing with me kind of knowledge about, like, you know, business plan. And this is in reference to V2V in Vegas. And they're like, oh, you've got to do this. You've got to really nail it in year one because that's going to, you know, have, you know, this big impact on year two and three and whatever. And I was like, hold on, guys, you know, like, but it's a very valid point in traditional business. And then, you know, whether you're talking brick and mortar or anything else, but with the nice thing about, you know, the events business, the industry is every year, you know, it's going to be different. It should be different. It has to be different. And that's one of the things that I think Hugh has been great about. You know, when I'm always kicking and screaming about, can't we do what we do just better in terms of user experience? You know, Hugh's always good about pushing, like, well, what are we doing that's new and fresh and, you know, that we can offer people? And so I think that balance between, you know, Hugh pushing the new and fresh and me pushing the better user experience and kind of the discussions and arguments that we have about what to do, along with, you know, feedback from the rest of the team. And obviously, you know, our Christine Otten, who I share an office with, you know, heads up our efforts with V2V. You know, like, we all kind of aware of a lot of the challenges that our community and audience is having at South by Southwest. And it's awesome to have each year kind of take a new crack at these things. And I'm kind of excited about some of the things that we're cooking up for March 2014. So
yeah, well, I will say, like, it's been very responsive. I mean, 1 year the Wi-Fi was just so terrible. I think it was probably the first, probably 2005 to 2007. Not sure which year it was, but Wi-Fi was just terrible. Then it was awful. I think, and then the next year, I think, you know, there's AT&T rolled out like so many mobile trucks or something like that, and for Wi-Fi. Yeah. And ever since then, I've, you know, there hasn't been a really as bad issue with the internet access too. So, like, you definitely see that you guys are responsive.
Sure.
From 1 year to the next. So.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. You know, I think that, you know, I definitely think that what's interesting now is, like, you know, I was talking about this kind of concept of micro events, right? And it kind of, so we essentially have 15 different events in one now for South Coast Interactive. So if you're a web developer, you can go hang out at this part of the convention center. And if you think of yourself as more of a startup guy, you can go over to this part of, you know, the Hilton. And it really goes back to what I was talking about earlier with the filter bubble and, you know, how you really have to be conscious about what your process is in terms of how you expose yourself to new ideas. So in this South is the West of the Golden Past that everybody loves, you know, we didn't structure the event that way. So we didn't have to, because you'd pop out of one panel room and you would run into a bunch of business guys that knew a lot about, you know, stuff that you didn't know about, or
right,
or vice versa, or, you know, and that hallway magic that happened back at a smaller scale is something that really resonated with everybody. Well, a lot of that hallway magic is still there, but now, you know, you have to put it on yourself, like, all right, I'm a web developer. Maybe I shouldn't go to the design and development part of the event. Maybe I should go over to this DIY maker and hacker part of the, you know, and expose myself to a lot of new ideas that are happening there. And I think that that's really kind of one of the big trade-offs that we've had to make as event organizers, to really, you know, create those serendipitous interactions. Now, just, it does require people thinking outside of the box a little bit, and so we always do different programs to encourage people to kind of go to sessions that they may have never imagined themselves going to before. And I think that that's an important step in how we learn new things. And you know, events that I go to, I certainly get a lot of value out of that. And so, but yeah, I think, you know, for us, it really is the challenge now with the March event, is like to build the best tools that we can for people to be able to discover the new ideas to them, and better navigate the events, and we deal with some of the capacity issues that we're dealing with. And so that's really kind of the next big challenge for us as far as the March event goes. And you know, V2V, doing this in Vegas, was definitely a part of that equation of like, okay, well, what happens when we take the fastest growing sector of South Southwest in March and build this optional platform in Vegas? And because we, in Austin, we no longer have the infrastructure to really support that growth of that particular micro event, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I'm speaking from Capital Factory right now, and Capital Factory has a startup event, and it was just slammed up here with people before the event. So, that brings up another point, is like, you know, you have growth, that hallway magic that you have with South By in the beginning, and then there's so much growth, but yet you still want to, and you try to address that with, I guess, different events in one event. And you kind of mentioned that with, like we just said, like, what are the changes in the growth in the industry have you seen over the last few years? I mean, so is, I guess, the startup culture the fastest growing one, or, and how is it different than it was when, you know, like 10 years ago or 7 years ago?
I think in general, I mean, obviously the startup culture, and that can kind of mean anything in a lot of ways. Yeah. You know, so many people are startups and don't necessarily frame themselves in that way, or as an entrepreneur, but, and they may be. But I think that in general, you know, when I look at kind of, you know, the 10-year span, you know, obviously, I guess the kind of advertising agencies and digital marketers have showed up to the party. Mm-hmm. A good way of saying it. You know, obviously, 10 years ago, you know, the web was very important, but, you know, it's still such a new industry, you know, this crazy intersection of a lot of different things. And, you know, now I think that's, you know, really how the community has kind of evolved, you know, is it's a diverse community. Mm-hmm. We've got, you know, agencies involved now. We've got, you know, people that are just writing code because they love it. We've got, you know, just a diverse group of people to service and provide value for. And that's really challenging, you know, and I think that, but yeah, like, per your question, I think that's really like the people that, you know, deal with the monetization, for lack of a better word, have showed up to the party. And, you know, a big part of my job is to basically help keep the focus on the stories of Southwest that are happening about people that are just doing amazing things with technology. And because that's really what we want to showcase. And that's, you know, really the magic of what is happening at South by Southwest.
So, yeah, so I know South by Interactive is a, you know, digital you know, conference or festival. So would you just say that the web is the platform and it's one, and now that we've just, you know, it's solid and we're actually just moving on and seeing which industries on top of web are expanding, and that just happens to be entrepreneurs and startups and stuff like that. And then it could be something else different down the way, or?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, I feel is that a core value of the web is, you know, easy access to not only information, but the tools to create amazing things. And I think that, you know, I hope that that continues to be the case, and that, you know, I want those tools, you know, and this kind of connects back to what we talked about before with it, you know, with playing in bands in the late 90s. I want to continue to kind of foster that so that everybody has the tools to learn, whether it's web design or, you know, any other coding technology, or just how to share their story online and do amazing creative things in the online world as well as the offline world now. You know, and I think that, you know, kind of you're asking about trends, you know, I mean, I think those of us who have been working on the web for a long time, you know, we build these amazing digital experiences and they have a shelf life of 2 to 3 years and you have to launch Rock That Font version, whatever. Mm. But, and I love doing that. And it's an amazing, mysterious kind of evolving community and platform. And I think what's fascinating to me, or what I've been turning a lot more of my personal attention towards, is this maker space, obviously with 3D printing. Mm-hmm. I mean, just, I think it's one of these things that we look at and we're like, oh, I get it. But I don't think we really fully understand the impact that's going to have, that like I can take any idea and not just, you know, bring it to life in the digital world, but have it come back into the physical world. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you're basically, you know, through a very short path, being able to manifest ideas and to reality. I mean, it's pretty fascinating on so many different levels. And so I'm really excited about what's happening in that space. And I think, you know, what we're going to see with, you know, intellectual property law here in the next 5 to 10 years is going to make what happened to the music industry look like a Sunday picnic or something. It's
well, can you expand on that? Like, what do you mean by that?
Well, if I can take any object in my environment and digitally scan it, you know, we've had us of MakerBot debut his digitizer during his opening keynote this past March. So I can, if I take that, and there's other technologies out there, there's a wand that you can scan objects and then print it in a 3D printer, you know, without, you know, with very, you know, with very cheap tools. You know, 3D printers now are becoming very inexpensive, and the material science is about to take some leaps and bounds. You know, I mean, we read stories online about printed organs and printed meat and all kinds of other things, but particularly for the layperson, it's about to get really interesting. So, for example, if I decide, that particular widget that you have is super cool, hold on 1 second, and then I scan it and I just print one for myself. I mean, there's an analogy there to like, oh, that song from that band's pretty awesome. Let me grab that file from you. So I think we're going to again see the challenge of, what, you know, information, who owns information and what it is and where their rights begin and end, in the world. And I think there's obviously a lot of solutions, whether it's Creative Commons or anything else. But I think that, you know, again, this 3D printing and maker movement, it goes well beyond just like us, becoming like this, you know, new manufacturing thing again. I think it runs much deeper, and I'm so excited about the crazy possibilities there. And I think that space, just again, bringing what we're developing in the digital world back into the away from keyboard world, for example, is just so cool. I mean, it connects to like, you know, the quantified self movement, and, you know, I'm kind of becoming more and more of a data geek all the time. Like, I started finally getting around to just, for example, using Strava all the time. I'm kind of a big cycling dork. And so, you know, now I'm like looking at all this data and geeking out with that. And mean, obviously a lot of people with, you know, whether it's Fitbit or anything else.
Right.
Again, it's that digital becoming more pervasive in our lives, and of course the Internet of Things, and
I can definitely see where like someone could come up and say like, hey, like a kid says like, hey, I have a Hot Wheel racer car, like you want a copy of it, and just put it into the 3D printer and it has a copy of it, and then all they paid for was the parts for it, you know, for the material, right?
Yeah.
Right. And so I think iTunes has solved this. They'll just, you know, is this person authorized to have this Hot Wheel car? Yes or no? Like, sorry. And so,
sure. I do think though that, you know, I certainly hope that, it's going to be challenging on a lot of levels, because I think, you know, a 3D printer and scanner and you know, the way the software, you know, once that gets a little more friendly in terms of CAD stuff, I mean, like it's so easy to have an independent setup. Like you don't have to talk to anybody else. You don't have to have,
mm-hmm.
And that's, I think it's great. You know, I think it's, you know, this is the kind of technologies that you can put in developing environments, and you know, it's going to take, you know, the whole shipping of products around the world or trying to get things into difficult regions. You know, I think that's where, you know, we're going to see a lot of amazing changes too down the line to shipping and distribution. Like the idea that, all right, I'm going to put this little 3D printing lab in the middle of Africa, and it's going to be able to pump out parts to help, you know, machinery or farm equipment or, you know, whatever it is. Like, we're going to start to see some crazy impact in those environments. And, but yeah, you're right. The kids and the Hot Wheels, they're the ones that are going to be,
Yeah, well, I just hate it when I have a new Mac and I'm like, hey, I want to play this song that I know I own. And they're like, oh, you're not authorized to have this. And I'm like, ah, oh, I totally am. And I have to like deauthorize every computer. And then I have to like, oh, start authorizing everything. So basically I just see a kid just like, hey, I want a copy of that. It's like, oh, sorry. You, Johnny, are not authorized to have this car.
Yeah.
So yeah.
But, you know, that's the thing. It all depends on kind of what happens with these, essentially the kind of CAD software and, you know, how that gets put into the cloud or not, you know. You're right. It's there'll be some solutions that are there, but
yeah,
it's always open for folks as it is now to, you know, go through the trouble to do whatever they need to do to make their own.
Mm-hmm. Johnny's going to make his own car.
Yeah. I'm totally going to make my own car.
And it's going to be better and better than the other one. But well, one thing I want to talk about is the panel picker for South By and how that could come about and I guess how it's relied on the other festivals too, right? Was that right?
Yeah, like we use the panel picker now, not just for interactive, but for music and film, which we've been doing for 2 or 3 years now at least. The panel picker came about in 2006 or so. Might have even been late 2005. We were looking at a lot of the youngsters around the office that were, you know, buying all these shirts for like $10 and really strong designs, and it was from a company called Threadless. And, you know, we were fascinated by how Threadless operated. You know, we thought it was like this brilliant, you know, model of, you know, having the community not only design the product, but determine the demand for the product. And, you know, just this amazing community and doing a lot of fun stuff. And, you know, we're sitting there and Hugh's like, well, why don't we do this for the conference? Because we need a way to kind of, you know, formalize all these calls for proposals. You know, at the time, you know, people would just email us with like, hey, I've got a great idea for a panel.
Right.
It's getting to the point where we couldn't manage that anymore. We thought that a system like this would kind of really help us determine what ideas would be more popular that we could put in bigger rooms and stuff like that. So we worked with a developer who at the time was the webmaster of the Austin Chronicle, which was right across the volleyball court from the Southwest office, who, oddly enough, you know, when I was talking about the Apple II that I owned with my family as a child, This was a buddy of mine that would come over, and we would geek out and kind of write code together and dork around with this, 1200 baud modem or whatever the heck it was. And his name's Lindsay Simon. And so Lindsay and Hugh and myself just kind of, co-developed this panel picker application that we put together in fall of 2006 and crowdsourced the conference for the first time. And, I think what we didn't realize at the time was how the panel picker was much more than just a formal way to collect call for proposals. Again, the kind of one of the things I talked about in my DrupalCamp talk was, embracing accidents. And two things kind of emerged out of that that were accidental that were really positive. One, the kind of, marketing engine of it. If somebody submits an idea and it's online and people can vote for it, they would turn around and really rally their audiences and their community to have them involved in Southwest. And so people doing this through social channels, really helped spread awareness of the interactive event and what we were doing in Austin. Mm-hmm. And to these days, it's to kind of an irritating degree, I think. But, I think the other thing that was, I think, much more intriguing was the idea that, now that it's kind of reached a certain scale, we'll get, over 3,000 different ideas that people want to see happen in Austin. We have a really interesting data set of what people want to talk about. And so when you compare this data over time, you start to see trends emerge and start to see the seeds of the future. And, because you do have this really unique community, that are early adopters, that are out there, building cool new stuff all the time. And so that's something that I try to do more and more of, is basically look at that data and try to kind of, help us build tools to look at that, which a lot of, I think, big, advertising companies and stuff, agencies sell a lot of tools for folks to look at Twitter and Facebook and look at all that data and mm-hmm. see what's coming down the line. For a particular brand or whatever. But, I find that the panel picker and what we've seen kind of emerge and disappear. I think, the example that I first started using when we started talking about this publicly was, we could tell that the kind of quote unquote web was going away, meaning that when you even did a simple like Wordle kind of analysis, the language of, the web was changing because as digital kind of started pervading every aspect of our lives, there was no longer this distinction between the web and, the quote unquote real world or meat space. And, that Wired, I think, was able to kind of jump on this. And I think it was a Chris Anderson article where he said, the web is dead, and like, here's why, and kind of talked about that aspect of the ubiquity and the Internet of Things and all of that. So we were able to see a lot of that, as well as the emergence of social, and a lot of the social stuff that came out of the event, as well as, just the word analysis. We could even see kind of how people talked about social technologies changed as we come that, that became more of just something that was part of all of our experiences online in the digital space. So, there's been a lot of cool things like that. And I think now we just wrapped up our submission phase where people had shared a lot of ideas that they wanted to see happen in March. And here on Monday, voting is going to begin. Get ready for your social streams to
blow up,
light up with people wanting you to vote for their panel paper submission.
All right. Thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and it's important too. I mean, with that, so the first year we did the panel picker, it was what you would call kind of a pure, Hugh and I looked at the voting data and really let that shape the event in 2007. And we got a lot of feedback that year that the panel sessions just, didn't have the same quality, and, it was a very unusual mix of people. And we always like to keep a lot of what we call fresh blood of like speakers that have never spoken publicly before. Mm-hmm. But we also know that a lot of people who are geeks or nerds, like not everybody's like you, Chris, where, you know, they're nerds and they can also do a great talk, you know, like, in some ways these are very different talents for a lot of people. And so, yeah, a lot of the most brilliant minds, you know, the interview format is a little bit better for them. I'm just depending. But anyways, what my point is that the panel picker voting only accounts for about 30% of the process. So yes, it'll make a difference, but, you know, our advisory board, as you know, accounts for about 40% of the process, and then staff feedback is another 30%. And so we do, you know, over time we have curated a lot more the event and kind of brought in, you know, some top tier folks and featured speakers, you know, that we generally will curate a lot of that, but we still, you know, the bulk of the ideas, you know, do come from the panel picker and what the community is bringing to South by Southwest. And it's something that, you know, yeah, we're definitely proud of that we've got, we still have this platform where anybody in the online world can say, hey, this is what I think we should talk about at South by Southwest, and here's how I'd like to do it. And we give them the green light to do that. So
and that's one thing that I love about Southwest is, like, if you've never spoken at an event, it might be a little harder now, but, like, it was always like a way to break into speaking as a way to do that. And so I think it's a little bit harder now with, you know, probably have to have a really good idea and concept and everything like that. But I do want to talk about the internal picking, like what type of, if you don't mind, like, I guess, you know, peeking back a little bit of behind the curtain is, like, what is the process of,
sure,
of the internal stuff that Topline does?
Things have evolved in a lot of ways over the years and have not changed in others. The panel picker has gone through a couple different evolutions. I think it was just ahead of last year's panel picker. So what is that? Summer before last, we had launched a kind of new version of the panel picker that had been written for the ground up. And you know, as I mentioned, it's for film, music, interactive, our eco event, and our EDU event. And next year will be for our V2V event as well, this platform. So, you know, we do the panel picker voting phase, and then we use a couple different things. So we have a custom web judging app, essentially, that's an interface that we use also for our web awards and use for in other ways to look at ideas. But as far as internally, you know, South by Southwest is unusual in that we've had Macs and been a Mac company since the beginning. And so we use FileMaker for our end users, which a lot of people are surprised by that. But for us, because we have so many different things going on, it makes a lot of sense, you know, to basically educate the staff to be able to produce their own layouts and do some different things with the data that they need to do. We have a FileMaker backend or, you know, server for the end users, and then, you know, various platforms online for everything. And we've been doing more and more kind of custom applications. And I think actually, you know, that's an interesting kind of thing, you know. What sets South by Southwest apart in terms of the tech and geek end of things is we've always preferred to build our own tools instead of use somebody else's. And I think, like, even, you know, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and the reason why we did this is we always, you know, wanted to maintain control over, you know, what we could do with the data and what we needed to do with the data. And I think in the end, you know, that was... it's been much more cost effective for us to do, to get what we want and be nimble enough and make changes and kind of, you know, have a lot of these custom applications. And as a result, I mean, we definitely went through a really tough time where, you know, getting data in and out of FileMaker, into various online platforms was really challenging. Mm-hmm. But once Rails came along, you know, we could do a lot with, like, PHP movers, and we're able to move data around much more easily. And so, So yeah, it's a mix of a lot of different things, but we'll pull after the voting phase, once that ends, actually we start a lot of this analysis even before the voting period of the panel picker ends, but you know, we're looking at ideas, we're assessing what's really creative and valuable about them, and we're doing a lot of that in FileMaker. So,
okay. Well, what type of, like, you know, you notice how we've grown from the web to a different type of talks that get entered into. It's like, as you have panel picker decide 30% and advisory board does 40%, you know, what type of talk would you like to see, or do you like to see, like, when you're making that cut, like, that, you know, it's on the edge or not? Like, what would give a talk a nod more than another a talk?
Sure. Proposal? And we're pretty transparent. I mean, you know, we do have a bunch of blog posts about, you know, what makes a good panel picker proposal from our perspective. But I think the first and most important thing is really the scope of what you're going to talk about. I think so many people come in and they want to talk about something that's happening in the industry, and it's just too much to cover in a 60-minute presentation or panel. That, I think, is the number one thing that people do wrong. They want to cover too much for the time. And that, you know, they may have a great idea, they may have incredible speakers lined up, but it just comes down to like trying to do too much for the time. And, you know, because I think so clarity of what you're trying to communicate to an audience is like really important, realizing what those takeaways are going to be. So having very clear takeaways is another thing. And, you know, I mean, we've made it no secret that, you know, in recent years we really like solo and dual presentations. Mm-hmm. We tend to agree with a lot of people that, you know, the panel format in many ways is dated, and it definitely has its place and its strengths and its opposite west, but, you know, it's not for every topic.
Right.
And so we really do place a priority on the kind of solo and dual and these other formats, like our core conversations, which are more of an informal panel, if you will, or birds of a feather, kind of a strange mix of that. And then we have our Future 15 short form presentation. So, you know, we've been playing around with the different formats for a while to basically help speakers convey the maximum amount of value within a certain set time. And so that's important to us. But I think, you know, also something that's part of the panel picker process is, you know, this aspect of diversity, whether it be gender diversity or, you know, anything else. Like, you know, nobody wants to hear from, like, you know, somebody and their friends about, you know, any topic. And so, you know, having the diversity of opinion on a panel, you know, having, you know, putting panels that somebody proposes and they've got their competitors on the panel with them, it's always, you know, a good sign, because, you know, that means they're open to those kind of discussions happening at South by Southwest. And so, yeah, there's a lot of different things we look at, but those are a couple of things that come to mind.
Okay. And another thing I just realized just talking to you is, like, the start of the panel process and the actual delivering of a speaker actually delivering it encompasses and actually overlaps entirely the U.S. Football season. All right, so you've already asked for submissions, you got them going, and then by the time it comes to deliver, I mean, we've already had the Super Bowl, right? So
yeah.
I mean, so the panels that get picked or submitted now or like recently, you know, and technology changes so much, you know,
yeah,
like what,
you know, yeah, we definitely have addressed that in a couple different ways. A number of years ago, based on a lot of feedback, you know, we started doing like what we call late break programming. We, you know, we've gotten this feedback, I guess, a number of years ago. We, you know, we're addressing this issue, and we developed what we call like late break programming. So we have entire tracks of programming within the event that we don't program until very late in the game to address this and to address that issue. And then, you know, we do leave a lot of slots open, a lot of the kind of curated components of it by staff until kind of the last minute. So, yeah, there are a lot of, you know, obviously a lot of the panels that come together 9 months ahead of the event in terms of their idea, general concept, you know, and we see an evolution of that at times. I mean, sometimes we'll see some, you know, particular panel, they'll make some changes at the last minute to accommodate new stuff that's come into the event. So we do leave a lot of that up to organizers of sessions. But at the same time, we have the late buried tracks, as well as a lot of other curated sessions at the event that come in at the last minute and deal with that same issue. And I think, you know, we many years ago, we kind of learned about that, you know, and a lot of the feature programming tracks we put together. I remember it was probably 2 or 3 years ago now, but, you know, we had, we're always approached, I guess, in February by like really interesting people that want to be part of the event. And in some cases, you know, we wouldn't have the room. And, you know, so we always, you know, we always have a few people who have to drop out at the last minute.
Right.
As well as, you know, leaving a couple slots open for a lot of this stuff that's coming in late is part of the whole design of the event. So.
Cool. I guess you keep on your toes then.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, that's a big part of, I guess, the real challenge of working on the event, too, once it gets to a certain scale, is that balance of making sure that we have the latest industry issues, the latest relevant folks involved, and at the same time, you know, get it done ahead of, you know, a lot of our deadlines for putting together, whether it's print materials or getting all the information online and the schedule as quickly as possible. So, like, we'll do our first big programming announcement in October this year. Mm-hmm. And that'll have, you know, at least half of the event as far as the different ideas that were accepted from the panel picker. And, you know, I mean, we want people to know what they're getting into, you know, when they buy a badge and to kind of know what they're going to get out of it. And so that's a big reason why we make that first announcement in October.
And so as we record this, then next week is going to be the big onslaught of tweets for people to vote on 2014's sessions. So I guess we'll be prepared for that. Yeah, cool. I think it's, you know, I love going to it. I live in Austin, so I don't have to Airbnb that one. But yeah, I hope everyone else can come out to it, because it's just really great to have a big party in the backyard. And yeah. And please, kudos to, you know, the whole team over there too, because I organize conferences. I never ever want to be on the scale that you guys do. But you guys, I can't. I know it's not you guys just alone. It's the whole volunteer team and everything. It blows my mind how many cogs need to be working at the same time for everything to work together. So
it's amazing, and it's, you know, it certainly is a community event. Every aspect, from people submitting ideas to the panel picker, from our volunteer army, you know, to all the different staffers here and departments, it is pretty amazing that it continues to happen every year. We don't take that for granted. You know, we really are honored that everybody continues to come to the event in March and make it really special. You know, because I'm telling staffers all the time, you know, our responsibility is to build the best playground we can and really, you know, have the nuts and bolts there for folks to plug into and show off what they're doing and their creativity and their creations and emerging technology. So, but yeah, thanks so much for having me today.
And thanks to Sam for being co-host today.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Cool. And how can people find you online on this? I guess, especially on social medias, except for Facebook, how can people find
me? They can't find me on Facebook anymore, but there are other Sean O'Keefe's. You're more than welcome to talk. I've got, at Sean O'Keefe on Twitter, just SHAWNOKEEFE, SeanO'Keefe.com. It's got, you know, my email address and various ways to contact me there. If it's Southwest West related, just Sean@SXSW.com. So it's pretty easy to find.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks again, and talk to you soon, man.
Yeah, thanks so much.